You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tony Greenham, Director of Economy, Enterprise and Manufacturing here at the RSA, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you here for today's event. Let me introduce today's speaker, Christian Felber. Christian is a lecturer at the Vienna University of Economics and Business, and is the author of several books, including 50 Suggestions for a Fairer World, New Values for the Economy, and Change Everything, Creating an Economy for the Common Good. He's also the initiator of an international movement of the same name, Economy for the Common Good, and has more recently launched a project called Bank for the Common Good. So the initiative started in 2010 and is supported by more than 2,000 businesses from 40 countries. The ultimate goal is to create change by awarding legal benefits to socially responsible companies and encourage them to pursue the common good and report on it. So he will tell you all about this. And I should just say there's an interesting piece of context, because this week on Monday, the government, the Cabinet Office here in the UK, launched an inquiry into mission-driven businesses. It wants to double the size of that sector. Businesses that make a profit but have at their core an activity which they consciously want to have a positive social and environmental impact, which nicely begs the question, how will we know whether those businesses are actually producing that benefit? So over to you, Christian.
Thank you for the invitation. The decadent, international, but individualistic capitalism is not intelligent. It is not beautiful. It is not just. It is not virtuous, and it doesn't deliver the goods we need. In short, we dislike it, and we're beginning to despise it. But when we wonder what to put in its place, we are extremely perplexed. John Maynard Keynes in 1933. If you're a bit less perplexed after this conversation, I regard it as highly successful. Thanks for inviting to introduce you to a possible alternative, a more beautiful economic model than the capitalism that we are witnessing at these times. And I'm happy to introduce you a possible alternative. It's not only John Maynard Keynes who was desiring an alternative. Today, between 60 and more than 80% of 40,000 consumers asked in 20 countries say that the current model does not serve the society as a whole and the planet. In Germany, the Bertelsmann Foundation, which is very close to the government, found out that 88% of the citizens desire a different, a new economic order in these literal terms. And in Austria, one of the most beautiful countries on earth, the most affluent country, 90%. How that? People in Mexico or in South America or in Spain, the youth unemployed with more than 60% unemployment rate, they can't believe that these numbers. And the answer is that the crisis is not an isolated crisis. It's not only a financial crisis or a bank crisis or a sovereign debt crisis or a crisis on the labor markets. It's a holistic crisis with an equal number of immaterial aspects and facets than material aspects and facets. I don't go deeper. I just refer to the crisis of meaning, crisis of values, crisis of democracy, crisis of concentration of power and loss of liberty, and the crisis of our environment. This is the deeper reason why such a huge majority is asking for alternatives. Alternatives in the very plural, although some very prominent politicians said and keep saying that there is no alternative. You still remember Margaret Tina Thatcher? There is no alternative to what I consider good and right. And today, other politicians are repeating it. But as there are alternatives, the answer from the civil society is tapas. There are plenty of alternatives, and they're as delicious and as diverse as the Spanish tapas. And the economy for the common good is just one of them. And it's possibly the youngest alternative. That's why you don't even find it yet on this slide. It started 5 years ago, and it has spread to more than 40 countries. And asking why it is growing so rapidly, the answer again, it's a truly holistic alternative. It's not only a theoretical model, complete and consistent, it's also a very alive process of participation and implementation. Thousands of citizens in more and more countries are engaging actively in the process. And third, we have learned a very bitter lesson that it's not sufficient to have a beautiful and attractive alternative if our governments and parliaments don't like it. So we searched for a democratic, a more democratic process of implementation for those ideas and alternatives that are backed by the majority of the citizens but disliked by their representatives. But I start with the theoretical model. And I want to confess that I'm not an economist. I do teach at Vienna University for Economics and Business since almost 10 years, but I did not study economics or business administration. And the reason is because the academic approach or vision perspective on the economy is too narrow for my needs. I wanted to study universal sciences, but very interestingly, at Austrian and German universities, you cannot study universal sciences because they forgot what the name means. University comes from universe, and universe means unum versum, one single verse, one poem, if you want so, or at least a wholeness. That's what the word originally meant. But universities don't offer access to the whole of the wisdom or the knowledge, but just to fragments, in many cases cleanly separated one from each other. That's why I suggest to rename them today coherently in multiversities, polyversities, or even perversities, because they're... and that's literal. You mean to pervert means just to put upside down, to put from the feet on the head. And I studied languages instead of having studied economics. And economics I did not study because it's not only a very young fragment, but a very small fragment, and becoming ever smaller, suffering a progressive intellectual impoverishment and separation from all other disciplines and contexts. And it's the most forgetting science that we have. Economic science is becoming multiply autistic because it forgot both its name and its roots. I'm frequently invited to business schools and faculties of economics at many universities, and I ask students, you know what the name of your science means? They have no idea. They have no idea that oikos, the house, is in the name of the science, and to which house this science refers, which house this science is investigating. Nor the small house, the human household, where the goal is to satisfy human needs, nor the bigger house, which is the planet, the ecological house, where all economic values come from in the end. And they also have forgotten where the science comes from. Because if you want to talk to economists today, to mainstream economists, of course, about feelings or values, often the answer is, well, that's a very interesting issue, but let's talk about that afterwards in the private sphere. And the most famous economist of all times, who was it? Adam Smith. Yeah. Was he an economist? He wasn't only not an economist, he could not be an economist in the midst of the 18th century because there was no such thing as an economic science at that time. He was a fellow of the RSA, but his chair was for philosophy and even for moral philosophy in Glasgow. And before writing the famous Wealth of Nations, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. So he was an expert on feelings and on values. And philosophy means that he was a lover of the wisdom. So if you consider the economy together with feelings, together with values, with ethics, together with the environment and human societies, I consider that wiser than that what we currently regard as economic science. And I think the most dangerous result of that progressive autism is that economic science is mixing up goals and means. That's the unwisest result of this progress of separation from everything. If I ask students of economic studies what is the goal of the economy, the answer usually is to make money, make profit, profit, money, money, profit, profit, money. And ask, but who says that? Well, that's what we are taught, Mr. Felber. And then I ask, but what reason do those who teach you this give you? And then they say, no idea. We know what's the goal, but we do not know why that shall be the goal. To my intuition, as a holistic thinker, I also listen not only to my feelings, but also to my intuition. And the intuition says that the goal of the economy is the common good. As the economy is not an end in itself, it's an instrument at the service of human societies that shall enhance the values of that societies, respect the democratic rules, and the ecological limits of the planet. And if you think that's a crazy idea, then I show you some constitutions of democratic countries. And they agree completely. I think this is a crystal clear saying from the Bavarian constitution. And the good news is that this is not an exception of the rule. This is the rule without a single exception. No matter which constitution of a democratic we look up, what's the overarching goal for the economy, all of them tell us the same. It's the common good. Watch that of Colombia. Economic initiative is free. That's not the point. But it finds its limit when it endangers the common good. Even in the Constitution of the United States, which we might consider the most capitalistic country on earth, we find the goal of the nation is not the increase of the money supply, but of the general welfare. And this does not mean that money is a bad thing. It just means that it's not the goal. The increase of capital and the use of capital is not the goal, but a means. And that's a very important distinction, which we already could have learned from Aristotle if we learned his thesis in our economic studies. But sadly, in many economic studies, he's not taught because he was not an economist. But he distinguished very clearly between the oikonomia, where money is just a means to achieve the goal, which is the good life and the just society, from the krematistike, where this relationship is inverted, is perverted, and the means becomes the goal. And the striving for money he called krematistike, which is a synonym for capitalism. This inversion of goals and means, what we're practicing, is so important that I show you in a chart which I brought. This is this inversion. You see, it works. We can do it. But it doesn't work for everybody. And now I try to show why this is so relevant. It's so relevant when we look at the way we measure success in the economy. Today, we measure success on all levels of the economy according to very familiar indicators of success. What's the success indicator for a national economy? GDP. What's the success indicator of a single company? The profit, the financial profit. And what's the success indicator for an investment? The ROI, the return on investment. We know, we agree on that. And what do they have in common? Money is the unit of measurement of all of them. And now, two very mean questions. First mean question, is money the goal of the economy? According to many constitutions, clearly not. And now the meanest question of all, which is, as for the method, more correct, to measure success alongside the means and their accumulation, or alongside the goal and their achievement? What is more correct as for a method? I think there is no exception in the whole world where we try to measure the success alongside the means and their accumulation. So it's a failure of method. Unless we argue that constitutions are wrong and that economic practice is right. That might be an argument. And the movement for the economy for the common good is not a dogmatic movement. We do not say constitutions say that the common good shall be. No, we are a democratic movement. And we say there is a confusion or even a contradiction. So let's clarify that. And let the sovereign and free citizens decide. And if the free and sovereign citizens decide that the accumulation of capital shall be the goal of our economic activities, then we can continue with the present practice. But we ought to correct our constitutions. If the citizens agreed with the constitution, say, no, no, we agree, the capital is only a means and the goal is the common good, then we ought to correct the way we measure success in the economy and adjust it to the goal that's in the constitutions and that we confirm democratically. And then we need different success indicators. And the next good news is that the German government asked their citizens if they want to continue with the GDP as the highest goal for the economic and social policy or replace it by a more comprehensive indicator that measures life quality, common good, and happiness. And the result was that 18% of the German population, asked by its own government, preferred the GDP to continue to be the highest goal for the economic and social policy, and 67% preferred to replace it by a gross national happiness or a more comprehensive life quality indicator. So this is already a quite reliable sign that people would prefer what we propose. And the next good news is that there are already some common good products. The OECD has developed the Better Life Index, not only the Good Life, a better one. The New Economics Foundation here in London has developed the Happy Planet Index. And maybe the most charming one is the Gross National Happiness in the tiny state of Bhutan. What are they doing? They're asking thousands of households every 2 years on all aspects of life quality. How are you in comparison to last year? Will your children be once better off than you? Only this question, asked in the 1970s in Germany, Austria, everybody would have agreed. And today, I think that's a decline of life quality. Do you trust your neighbors or the first person that comes along in the street? In Germany, trust in the public places has diminished by 50%, and fears of all kinds are sharply rising. On the contrary, how are the animals on the pasture, the trees in the wood? Is there still a wood in many countries? The fish in the river, can you eat the fish of the river? Can you take a swim in the river without a health risk? Can you drink the water of the river without a health risk? Our proposal is not to make copy and paste from the Bhutan and the gross national happiness, but to gather in our communities and municipalities where we live as free and sovereign citizens and compose the 20 most relevant ingredients of life quality to a common good index. And thanks to a process of synthesis, we create democratically the common good product. And if that rises, we will know for sure and reliably that our life conditions have improved in a significant aspect. Or there is less unemployment, less exclusion, less forced migration, less wars, more democracy and participation, healthier environment, more social cohesion, more solidarity and cooperation in the population, a deeper trust to our neighbors and other fellows. This is one reliable relationship, and another reliable relationship would be between the success of a single company and the success of the whole society. Do we have this relationship as a reliable one today? Is it possible that a company is successful and profitable and does good to everybody and the environment? Yes, it's possible. But the opposite is also possible. Is it possible that a company threefolds its profit and lays off thousands of employees and increases work pressure and contributes to burnout and mobbing rates and makes bigger inequality and discriminates against women and migrants and undermines democracy and destroys the environment? Very possible also. So there is no reliable relationship between the success of a single company and the success of society. Although exactly that was the dream of Adam Smith. Adam Smith had a very strong dream. He dreamt that free markets and private enterprises were led automatically to the common good. But the mechanism on which relied his dream was only hope. And hope is not a rigorous scientific method, is it? He once gave this hope a name, the invisible hand. But only once in a 800 pages book, only once. So it was a very hidden hope. And those who know him better assume that he referred to the hand of God. Today we know that the invisible hand is not only invisible, but it doesn't exist at all, and that God does not intervene in free markets. So to make Adam Smith's dream come true, we propose to create a visible hand. Then the dream is complete and viable, and the visible hand is the common good balance sheet. And the common good balance sheet makes that a company can only be successful in financial terms if it makes wealthier the society, if it contributes to the wealth of a nation and not to the poverty of a nation. And how do we measure it? You see the horizontal orange line. You see these values like dignity, solidarity, sustainability, justice and democracy. And you're probably familiar with these values. We did not invent them. We just looked them up in constitutions of democratic countries. And most democratic countries do have a constitution. And we just... it's a good thing. We just put them together and we ask to which degree and how authentically a company lives these values according to all its stakeholders. This is not a new method. A scorecard is a very familiar method. And in the fields of intersection, we define common good indicators. And the result, the ethical efforts and achievements of a company could be made visible and distinguishable, ideally, on every single product that we consider to buy in markets. And consumers will have a freer choice. The theory of a free market says that free markets are so efficient because the whole information is accessible to everybody. Let's make a simple proof. Does the average product in free markets tell us who produced it, under which working conditions, with which ecological impact, if the company is a solidarity one or a capitalistic one, if it pays a fair tax share or hides its profits in tax havens, if it finances political parties or pressure groups in their own interest, or orders a scientific study that proves the harmlessness of the poisons contained in this product? Do we get this information usually? We don't. So markets today are systematically intransparent and thus cannot be efficient by definition. The common good balance sheet will make markets more efficient, first. And second, we will correct today's relationship between the prices of more ethical products and less ethical products. Because on an average, the more responsible, sustainable, regional, and ethical products are more expensive than the less ethical products, which enjoy a competitive advantage in today's economy, which we do not consider as beautiful. As already put it, we consider it as anti-ethical. This is not an intelligent design. A more intelligent design would be a truly ethical market economy, where ethical products and services are more accessible because cheaper to consumers and investors than the less ethical products and companies. And how can we do it? Well, linking the common good balance sheet result to a differentiated legal treatment with mechanisms of incentivation that we already have today. None of them has to be invented. They have just to be consequently used for the values, the fundamental values that are already in our constitutions. One example, 1,000 common good points, highest possible score, no corporate tax rate anymore. But 0 common good points, well, the highest possible corporate tax rate. In international trade, very delicate aspect, the fairest, the most responsible company that pays attention to everybody and everything enjoys as a counter service free trade. But the unfairer and the more unsustainable and undemocratic a company, the unfreer the trade and the more expensive market access to world markets, or let's start with the European ethical common market. In the public procurement, the City of London or the United Kingdom or the European Union or the United Nations first ask companies for their common good balance sheet. And the red ones, well, they can apply, but they will never get a public order. And between the green ones and the yellow and maybe the orange ones, the public procurer also takes a second look at the price. And the banks, for the common good, we are founding one at this very moment in Austria, the first bank for the common good, will first check the ethical consequences of an investment before checking the financial risk of the loan requested. Today, economists, mainstream economists, and experts for finance consider an investment as successful if it generates a ROI, a return on investment. And if that ROI is double digit, then many of them get an orgasm. But does a double digit financial return on investment tell us something reliable on the ecological impact of that investment, on its effect on social cohesion, distribution, human dignity, trust in the society, democracy, or any fundamental value? On the contrary, it's possible that a double-digit return on investment diminishes the value of all of our fundamental and constitutional values, which we also can consider as common goods, our holiest common goods. And if our common goods are diminished in their values, we are expropriated and we become poorer as a society. So such an investment does not contribute to the wealth of the nation, but to the poverty of the nation. And economists don't see it because they don't have the necessary methods of measurement to evaluate it. And that's why the Bank for the Common Good will first check these consequences, and only if none of our fundamental values is diminished, only then the bank will do the financial risk assessment, and if both are passed, the money will flow. And the conditions will be the cheaper and the more favorable, the higher the ethical added value of that investment will be. Maybe that's too abstract and too theoretical. Before 1989, in the socialist part of Germany, there were stables for 50,000 pigs. I think that's a disaster. Now, in the same countries, they build stables for 100,000 pigs. And who is doing that? Agribusiness corporations from Western Germany and from the Netherlands. And the banks, do they give the agribusiness corporations more expensive loans or cheaper loans than to the local organic farmers? They gave cheaper loans, another perversion. Huh? And the Bank for the Common Good will ask first, which is the size of a group of pigs where pigs feel best and have the best life? I had once a professor for pig breeding in my talk, and he explained, well, Mr. Felber, you're asking very interesting questions in your talks, and I've just concluded a study of 3 years with my colleague between the differences of the house pig and the wild pig. And the only difference we found out was the color of the fur. And the house pig would love to have its nose every day 8 hours beyond the ground. And I said, Professor, that's a very astonishingly interesting study. Which is the average size of a group of wild pigs? 7. So asking people where they think that pigs feel best, many people guess that between 5 and 10 is the answer. That farmer would get the cheapest loan, and the agribusiness with 100,000 pigs would we charge him an interest rate of 150%? No, we wouldn't give him a loan at all. We would define a maximum limit of the group size of the pigs, and asking the audience, does somebody have a suggestion here? Very spontaneously. Which is the maximum size we want pigs to live in stables for human food?
70.
150.
10.
1,000. 1,000 would be the record so far. But in 100 occasions, nobody proposed a limit higher than 1,000. And that's exactly the difference between socialism, 50,000 pigs, capitalism, 100,000 pigs, and economy for the common good, 7 pigs, the cheapest one. So now you got it. The whole model is much more comprehensive. I now just talked about the goal, the values, the way we measure success, and a bit of the financial system. Totally, these are 20 cornerstones, but we do not demand their implementation. We only demand a democratic process. And in the democratic process, our ideas shall be discussed with other ideas and hopefully better ideas, and then the sovereign citizens would decide. That's the most important point, because the fundamental question of the economic order, if we let the decision to our governments and parliaments, they will not decide them. And probably the best example for that is the ever-increasing concentration of wealth and power and the consequent loss of democracy and liberty in our post-democratic societies. And our proposal is to enhance entrepreneurship, to enhance free enterprise, to enhance everybody to have a decent living income and standard, but to make the first million the easiest one and not the most difficult one, according to a true society of achievement. And somewhere, when inequality becomes excessive, we make it harder to become richer, more wealthy, more powerful, and somewhere we put a limit. And where the limit shall be put, that's a democratic decision. And why shall that be decided by the citizens? Because our parliaments don't even touch these questions. Our proposal of a sovereign democracy, to put it in a nutshell, is that we take the term of sovereignty literally. Sovereignty, which is the core principle of democracies, comes from Latin and means to stand above all. And you know who is the instance, the sovereign instance in a democracy, don't you? It's us. It's the people. And sovereignty comes from a term superanus and means to stand above all. Above all. That's the core, that's the heart of the democracy, that the people stand above all. And this would mean that the people could write the constitution, and the constitution regulates the power of the parliament and the government. And they do the laws like today, but we could correct them. And they conclude international treaties like today, but we could correct them. And if people wrote the constitution, I'm totally convinced that they would not allow banks to become too big to fail, to be rescued with taxpayers' money, to have free movement of capital to tax havens, to allow patents on living organisms, or unlimited inequality. We have surveys from the Financial Times that almost 80% of the Chinese population considers the current inequality as excessive. In the United States, it's 75% of the population. And in Germany, it's again 80% of the population. This does not mean that people are asking for full equality, because this is a reflex in a political debate. If you criticize excessive inequality, are you communist or what? No. Slowly. We just want to limit inequality. And I have played this game with 50,000 people from 25 countries, and that's the proposal where we could limit income inequality, defining the maximum multiply of the highest income according to the lowest income. Some want 4 times, some want 7 times, some want 15 times, some want 1,000 times. And the innovation of that method of decision making is that all proposals are voted, but not the affirmation to every single proposal, but the resistance against every proposed proposal. And the winner is that proposal that meets the least resistance. And the result is in 95%, the proposed factor 10 is the winner because it meets the least resistance according to a lower degree of inequality and also according to a higher degree of inequality. In 95%, from Finland and Sweden to Chile and Argentina, factor 10 is the winner. And if it's not the winner, then it's a factor very close to factor 10. That's the decision of the sovereign citizens. And this is the decision of our representatives in different countries. That's the current state of the art. And this is just one example. I've collected almost 100 examples where in fundamental decisions, we've seen the example of GDP and gross national happiness, second example. In the fundamental decisions, our representatives decide not only differently, but almost the opposite of what citizens deem as just, ethical, and their priority. To conclude, I show you just some pictures in 30 seconds. These were the first 12 entrepreneurs in Austria that started together with me that movement 5 years ago. Today, we count with 2,005 companies from more than 40 countries that support the movement, and 350 of them have done their common good balance sheet until the final stage. Amongst them, 3 banks, for instance, or a public university of applied sciences. They have a common good officer now. We have created 19 associations, legal associations in many different countries, which coordinate more than 150 local groups. There's a first chapter in UK, which you can get in contact here and now, or via internet. In Swindon yesterday, we founded the second group. If you can't read that, this is a municipality which says about itself, I'm a municipality for the common good. It's Spain in this case. And they're the first regional governments that made decisions to enhance both common good companies and common good municipalities. And the last information is that the European Economic and Social Committee, which is one of the 2 major advisory bodies of the Parliament, the Council, and the Commission, made a 10-page opinion on the economy for the common good. And they voted on it. And an incredible 86% of the members of the Economic and Social Committee of the European Union voted in favor of the economy for the common good and is now asking the European Commission to imply it in European law and the law of the member states. And still our strategy is a bottom-up process, and we invite warmly every individual to join a local group or to found one. Every company can do the balance sheet, every community or municipality can become a common good municipality, and every university can start with research or training. And this person encourages you to participate personally. His participation and his contribution was to define the human rights. And I think it was a good idea to engage for the Universal Declaration of the Human Rights. And maybe it's an equally good idea to engage for an economy for the common good. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Christian. That was a fantastic talk. I'm just going to ask a couple of questions. You flagged one of them, really, in your comments on the Constitution. And as you're aware, we don't have a codified written Constitution in the UK. I'm just wondering, when you do come to the UK, what you find people in the movement here refer to as the basis for, you know, choosing those values of human dignity and ecological sustainability. Mm-hmm. How are people coping with that? Because I love the fact that in mm-hmm. European countries you can just say, well, there's the Constitution, we'll follow that, and here's the common good mm-hmm. balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Help us. Mm-hmm. What do we do?
Yes. I've traveled to many countries, so far 25, and I don't notice a meaningful difference between British audiences and other audiences. So the fact of having or not a constitution, I don't see it as decisive. People refer to their intuition, to their reflected feelings, to their education, to their values, and they are more or less the same in the UK than and in other countries. I did the play, and the result in the UK was the same as in other countries. So constitution or the not existence of a written and codified constitution shall not be the hindrance. And I would even say in Austria we have a codified constitution, but it was not written by the people. And it was not even adopted by the people. And we will have its 100th anniversary in 3 years. And we take this fact as a motive and a trigger to write for the first time in Austria's history the constitution democratically. So we're in a similar situation, and I think the difference is smaller between writing for the first time a constitution democratically and writing for the first time a constitution democratically in a country that already has one, between the difference that we have now.
The RSA is actually just launching a project called the Citizens Economic Council, which is seeking to engage citizens in defining these goals. So we may have a chance to play your game. But actually, most democratic processes and representative democracy doesn't allow people to choose those outcomes in the way that you do it. So how is it going to make any difference? I mean, you are personally going to have to go to a lot of town hall meetings to sort of gather all those results. What's the mechanism for having impact on parliaments?
Well, the most relevant and important mechanism is the power of the idea. And if the idea is powerful, if the meaning of the word of sovereignty, all other elements of the democracy are below us, if that idea, if the word is powerful, then many diverse people and organizations and institutions and even city councils. We have some 50 municipalities queuing up to start with such a process. And in many times, those who take the initiative are the city councils and the mayors in these smaller, of course, in these smaller. So I think it's a need of both who are in power and who are powerless to change the current power relations, because they give virtually all power to the representatives and no power to the people, and this is not good for none of them.
It sounds as though, you think it will come from the ground up, with smaller city, regions, municipalities up towards national parliaments, maybe?
It will come up, but then this sounds a bit like Adam Smith, and I don't want to rely on the hope only, so we will do an effort to find consciously pioneer municipalities, which we have already found in different countries. And we will start processes of citizen participation, which are professionally moderated and which are scientifically accompanied. So it will be at the same time a political process of participation and a project of scientific research.
Great. One final question, and perhaps briefly, but I feel I have to bring up that, you know, the standard challenge against beyond GDP arguments is it's all very well for Germany, which is very wealthy, economy is doing very well, for citizens to say, oh, maybe we can just look at these other goals and prioritise those. But for many places on the planet, what they need is efficient. They need to maximise production. They need to feed and clothe and house people. So, you know, muddying the waters. So it's very clear profit and GDP. They're very clear indicators. You know, will this scheme not get in the way of actually the business of lifting people out of poverty?
I don't think so, because we cannot rely on that relationship. And if they did, we would also measure it with measuring directly to be lifted out of poverty. An alternative to the GDP measured all those goods that we associate to the GDP. So we like the GDP so much because we associate with GDP being lifted out of poverty, working places, higher income, and satisfaction of basic needs. And exactly that is measured with the common good product. So everything what is positive in a growing GDP will also make grow the common good product.
Great. Okay, well, let's hand it over to the audience. Start with the lady on the right here. Thank you.
Hi. How do you collaborate with movements such as B Corp?
Okay, great question. The gentleman in front.
My question was going to be, how do you collaborate with movements such as conscious capitalism?
Right, so B Corps, conscious capitalism. And the gentleman just behind?
Hi. You never mentioned the press. Where does that fit into the model? Could it help or could it hinder?
It means specifically newspapers or the media generally?
Means of mass communication, essentially, or, you know, in how it's controlled and how narrow and how broad and how democratic.
Great. Collaboration and the media.
Yes. Well, collaboration is not only a strategy but also a value. So we cooperate as for a principle with similar movements. And my third slide was a slide with a sample of our friends. B Corps were not there, and conscious capitalism was not there because the list was incomplete. But in other occasions, I had B Corps on the list and I had conscious capitalism on the list. And when we go to found a local group, we recommend that it starts with at least five members. And one member shall take care of companies, one shall take care of the city council, one shall take care of universities and schools, one shall take care of the internal organization, and one shall take care of strategic cooperation with other initiatives like B Corporations or conscious capitalism or those other transition town or solidarity economy or commons movement, which I had on the slide. Maybe a detail, but an interesting detail, a spin-off of the Economy for the Common Good is the Global Hub for the Common Good. And the Global Hub for the Common Good has a strategic orientation of connecting and articulating these different initiatives of the new economy movement, which is a kind of umbrella concept of these alternative movements. And in the first major event next year, both B Corporations and the Economy for the Common Good are invited to a global meeting. And the press or the media, I did not refer to, and I did not refer to money either. Both have in common that I consider them, or we consider them, as public goods. And what this means for the money is a whole evening. If you have heard about the sovereign money movement or the positive money movement, this is the direction where it goes. Money is consequently a means, consequently used for the common good, and the rules for the monetary system shall be made democratically. And I'm totally convinced again, because I have rehearsed it, that if the citizens designed the cornerstones, only the fundamental decisions of the monetary systems, they would, I already said it, they would not allow banks to become too big to fail. They would even oblige all banks, no matter if private or public, to be oriented to the common good, because they're part of the basic infrastructure of a society. And if they switch to profit orientation, then they undermine the whole society. They would give them the exclusive right to issue money to the central bank and not to the commercial banks. And they would decide that a loan can only be given for a real investment and not for financial speculation. And it can only be given to a real investment if it does not destroy the common goods. So these fundamental decisions, I have rehearsed them with many, many citizens, already today enjoy a majority. And you even can already find them in some constitutions, but they're just forgotten. And what does media as a public good mean? Very similarly, we will have a broad variety of plural and diverse media. And the most important criteria is to de-link pluralistic and diverse media from economic power. So the criteria we propose go in the direction of nobody is allowed to have property on more than one media, maybe two, but as a maximum two. And this is against this extreme concentration of oligopolies and even regional monopolies of the media. No media is allowed to be dependent on more than 0.5% from one advertiser, and a new media can only be founded by, let's say, five journalists with a professional experience of at least 5 years or something. These are just first attempts to define criteria, and then we could consider a part of public financing if the media meet these criteria. And for both public goods, media is a public good and money is a public good, holds true the same. I don't have the trust that our parliaments and governments will implement such a reform. The only instance that I trust that would implement such a reform is the sovereign citizens. For that, they need to have the power. For that, they need to have sovereign rights, which I did not talk about because this is the logical consequences of the sovereign instance. And one of the sovereign rights would be to write the constitution or to initiate the law if parliament and the government is doing nothing on an issue that really matters to the people.
You have the right to ask a question. Let's see your hands. This gentleman in the front.
Thank you, Christian. At this very moment in New York is the Shared Value Summit, trying to map out a new relationship between the corporate for the common good, as they see it, being a force for good in society, but using the power of the private sector for social impact and benefit. I'm wondering what you make of that.
I know Michael Porter, and I appreciate his approach of shared value instead of shareholder value. And again, he's missing on the list. And the list is longer. It comprises, let's say, 30 or even 40 alternatives, and that makes the argument that there are alternatives even stronger, because there are plenty of alternatives. As for now, the creation of synergy between these similar approaches, in the European Union, there is now a directive that has already been adopted by the European institution, which is now in national implementation, will oblige, in a first stage, major companies with at least 500 employees to do, besides their already today obligatory financial balance sheet — this is not a free choice from the companies, they have to do it, it's a unified balance sheet, it's externally audited by the financial auditors, and it has legal consequences, not only about the tax rate, the amount of taxes companies have to pay, but even if the result of the audit is that the company is in insolvency, then it cannot continue its economic freedom. And this directive is about an ethical balance sheet. And now there are, let's say, 20 or 25 different approaches towards an ethical balance sheet, from shared value over a global reporting initiative, big corporations, or the common good balance sheet. And our strategic recommendation is to define criteria that any non-financial standard or ethical balance sheet has to meet. And those standards that meet these criteria become part of the law. And then the companies can choose in a first stage one of these 5 or 6 or 7 remaining standards. And in the second stage, they are obliged to fusion. And they have to be unified to one single ethical balance standard. And in the universal future, the auditors will have enjoyed a holistic formation, and they will be able to check both the success according to the means of a company, the financial success, and the success according to the values and the goals of a company, the common good contribution. This will be one report of the success of a company as for the means and the goals, and the holistic auditors will check both in the future. That's maybe in 2025 to 2035.
Good. Well, you can all raise that in your next Brexit debate down the pub. In the meantime, we've got time for two more quick questions. The gentleman there and the lady on the side, please.
Hey, hi, Christian. Thanks for coming. It was really interesting. I guess my question will be kind of general, but it might be a bit tricky to kind of get a clean answer, but I wanted to ask you, what is your view on applying this inspirational model to a non-Western framework? So in the Middle East, in places like West Africa, where it's fundamentally an extraction-based economy in which they survive.
Hi, yes, so my question is the common good is common for most of us, but probably not for the 1%. And the 1% currently have the power. So how do we get from where we are now to the sovereignty that you describe and that I think most of us would love?
We've got two great but enormous questions, and you are going to have to deal with them, Christian, in about 1 minute.
1 minute.
Maybe 2 minutes.
Starting with the application of the model to non-Western countries, we are not trying that. I grew up in Austria, and now Austria is part of the European Union, so I refer to the European Union. And if there is interest in other cultures about the model, which is the case, then of course I'm happy to serve. But I'm all, at the same time, I'm happy to learn. And the best example is Bhutan. We learned the gross national happiness from Bhutan. And I make an advertisement from the Bhutan. And the German government asked if the people would like that that cultural jewel from Bhutan, and they want it. And now we are in a debate, and probably Bhutan will take over the common good balance sheet as a cultural exchange. And in Latin America, the philosophy of buen vivir does exactly refer to the same as the common good approach. And Ubuntu, as far as I have understood it, refers to the same. So actually, the economy for the common encourages universal values that exist in all cultures, albeit in different conceptions, to be implemented. And to my feeling, the most appropriate definition of the economy for the common good came from Central Africa. From a person from, I don't know, it was Ethiopia or a neighbor country. And he said, the economy for the common good allows us human beings to be as we always wanted to be. And I said, wow, I couldn't have put it in such clear words. And the second question?
The common good is not in the interest of the 1%. They're opposed. That was how I interpret that question. So how do you get over that problem? The 1% control it.
First, I doubt it. Because superficially, as human beings, have the capacity to betray ourselves, the 1% believes that if they stay rich and powerful and successful, they are happy. But we know from all scientists that it's not true in depth, and this according to interviews with themselves. So if we manage to help them to betray themselves a little bit less, more and more of them will help the 99%, one. But this is still no guarantee that the majority of the 1% will try to stick to power and even apply cruel means to conserve the power. So what's our proposal is to encourage and to empower the maximum number of citizens to start their alternatives in their businesses, in their banks, in their municipalities. And I think only if in hundreds of municipalities those democratic processes happen, only then we will have a national assembly to change the constitution or to write for the first time a constitution. And then this power of the 1% will cease. Because this we have learned from history. Those who base the power on violence are extremely powerful for some time, but for sure they will lose some point of time their power. And we have learned those ideas and those values who are shared by the powerless for some times do not give the power to the powerless, but in the long run we get democracy, we get human rights, we get gender equality, we get the overcoming of apartheid, and I think it's just a question of time when we get an economy for the common good.
That's what a perfect place to wrap up, both a positive note and a call to action. So please join me in thanking him very much for coming to present us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.